We're in the 24th chapter of Ezekiel this morning. Now, in this particular section is what I call the third cycle of speeches in which he's warning them of pointing out the sins of Judah and warning them of what was to come. Now, we remember that Ezekiel is in Babylon, but he's preaching to the people there of the things that have come to pass in Jerusalem. Because the Jews expected to go back soon. They thought there'd be a short time. They did not expect Jerusalem to be destroyed, but that they would return to it. But that's not going to be so. Now, was Ezekiel's mission was to point the people to the fact that Jerusalem was going to be destroyed. Its wickedness and its sins had reached a point. God could no longer tolerate it. It would have to be brought to an end. And that's God was going to do that. They ought to have learned that. God brought those nations to an end. When he gave the Jews the land of Canaan, he said the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. But when it was full, God could cast them out and give them that land. Well, he warned his people back in Deuteronomy over and over that if you don't follow my law and do this, I'll do the same thing to you. I'm going to cast you out. But they would not accept it. They didn't believe what God said. It was a nation of unbelief. Now, in this lesson today, now remember the last one, the last chapter we studied with Oholah and Oholibah, the two sisters of Israel and Judah, and their wickedness was such that God was going to cast them off. Now, let me continue that line of thought under different figures in this particular chapter. Now, the first figure here is that of a cauldron or a great big cooking pot, big enough to cut up and put a whole sheep in to boil it, to cook it. All right, and then after he cooks that, then he's going to burn the bones of it, of the animal put in. Then he's going to melt the pot. Well, the pot, of course, is Jerusalem. That which was in it was the people. God would destroy the people, and then he was going to burn the city, destroy it. So let's see what he said in the first five verses. Again, in the ninth year, in the tenth month, in the tenth day of the month, the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, before I look further, let me notice that passage is found, same period of time is in 2 Kings, the 25th chapter, and verse 1. 2 Kings 25:1. Now, this is the history from Jerusalem's point of view. And Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon, and it came to pass in the ninth year of his reign, in the tenth month, in the tenth day of the month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came, he and all his army, against Jerusalem, and camped against it, and they built forts against it round about. So the city was besieged in the 11th year of King Zedekiah, that's about a year and a half. All right, so that's the same date now, only God reveals it unto Ezekiel, that siege is beginning in Jerusalem. What? Also in Jeremiah, the 39th chapter, and I believe that's verse 1 also, you have Jeremiah identifying that same date, Jeremiah 39 and verse 1. If I can find it. All right. Yes, in the ninth year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the tenth month came Nebuchadnezzar of Dresden, king of Babylon, all his army against Jerusalem and besieged it. In the 11th year of Zedekiah, in the fourth month, the ninth day of the month, the breach was made in the city. So that would be a year and a half, you see. So it was a year and a half, they was besieged the city. I'm trying to get the picture of it. Remember now that Ezekiel had, in one of the pictures earlier, one of his discussions earlier, he painted a picture of those army out here camped just outside the city there, whetting their swords there, flashing them in the sun. Well, you can imagine being bound up in your city there, and camped in it, can't get out. The army surrounding here, sharpening their swords, and that goes on for a year and a half. That they're besieging the city there. And that's a good long time there before it finally fell. Now, that's the thing he's talking about here, now in this first verse. So he says, write thee the name of the day, even this self-same day. So we'll write this down. Now, why so particular in writing it down? Did you want to get that word? In writing it down. So that when the time came and the city fell, Nobody could say, well, Jehovah, our God, was too weak to preserve it. No, God told them the very day it was going to begin and how he was going to destroy it, and that the destruction would be of Jehovah. Jehovah would use the Babylonians to do it, but it would not be because of his weakness, but because of his purpose or plan and judgment against them. So he wants to make a note now of this date here. Well, some, of course, the liberal scholars try to say, well, he wrote it later and he knew when it was. No. Others say, well, how could he have known? Well, God revealed it to it. God could reveal that date before it took place there over here just as well as they could anything else, because, you know, when, or with him then in Babylon, and it's happening over in Jerusalem there, hundreds of miles away, and no means of communication. But he made it known the very day in which it began, even though they were a long ways from it. Now he moves on here. So he says here, the king of Babylon drew close unto Jerusalem that self same day, and utter a parable unto the rebellious house, and say unto them, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, set on the cauldron, set it on, and also pour water into it. Gather the pieces thereof into it, even every good piece, the thigh and the shoulder, fill it with the choice bones. Take the choice of the flock, and also a pile of wood for the bones under the cauldron. Make it boil well, yea, let the bones thereof be boiled in the midst of it. All right, now that's a parable. Well, did he actually act it out as he did some of the things, or did he just simply speak it unto them as a parable and kept repeating it? I don't know. He could have done either way, knowing that sometimes he acted out what he did. Now, I know the Bible says speak this proverb unto them. So it could be that simply he told them this and used this as a proverb or an allegory. Here, more here, proverbs or allegories than anything else. He could have made this an allegory, or he could have taken one of those big pots there, put a fire in it, underground it, put the sheet, cut it up, put it in there. The only thing is, would he be able to melt that pot? Could he have a fire hot enough to melt the pot later on? So it doesn't make any which way you take it. Whether he acted it out, or whether he spoke it unto them as an allegory of a pot here that, in which he put the sheep, I mean the bones of the flesh, and then cook it till it cooks away, and then burn the pot, melt the pot there. But we'll get the meaning of it in the next paragraph. Now it goes on now to explain what this is. Wherefore thus saith the Lord Jehovah, woe to the bloody city, to the cauldron, whose rust is therein, and whose rust is not gone out of it. Take out of it piece after piece, no lot is fallen upon it. So now then, Jerusalem is the cauldron. Now the people, the people in the city are parallel in the allegory to the pieces of the sheep were cut up and put in the cauldron, don't you see? So we get the picture there of a cauldron here. Jerusalem is the cauldron, and the sheep is cut up and put in it. Here are the people in the city, and now then the thing's going to be, they're all going to be destroyed, and then the city is going to be burned. Now, the rust in the city, in the pot, would spoil whatever you cook in it, have that little rust taste. Now some folks translate that as scum, but actually the word is rust, and not scum. And so the King James translated, I believe, scum, but the American Standard translated rust. Here the pot has become rusted from the pollution and corruption that's in it. Now then, and there's no way to get rid of that. You can't spread it out. So God is going to melt the whole thing down. That's the picture that you have there. All right? And he moves on here, the rust therein, and now no lot is to be taken apart. You're not to pick out this one and that one, put the whole sheep in there, and then as you take parts of it out, you reach in, take it out, not by lot. So the people are going to be destroyed, not this one spared and that one spared. The city will be destroyed. Now for her blood is in the midst of her. She set it upon the bare rock. She poured it not upon the ground to cover it with dust. Now that means that in the city, blood had polluted the city, had to where it was now, they'd have to pay the price of the whole city there to cleanse it. Now let me go back to a passage or two back in the fourth chapter of Genesis, where we have the start of this idea of covering a thing here with the when Cain slew Abel here. Now notice back here, and Jehovah said unto Cain, where is Abel thy brother? Verse 9. And he said, I know not, and I am my brother's keeper. And he said, what hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth upon unto me from the ground. Right, in other words, it was as if it were there on the ground crying out. And it was not covered. It had to be covered. Now let me notice, turn over to Leviticus, the 17th chapter, and verse 13. Another important verse along this line here. 17 and verse 13. Now notice 13. And whatsoever man that be of the children of Israel, or of the stranger to sojourn among them, who taketh in hunting any beast or bird that may be eaten, he shall pour out the blood thereof and cover it with dust. Alright? So, even if you killed an animal to eat, you had to cover it with blood, dust. Now, the next verse, 14. For as to the life of all flesh, the blood thereof is all one with the life thereof. Therefore I said unto the children of Israel, you shall eat the blood of no manner of flesh, for the life of all flesh is the blood thereof. Whosoever eateth it shall be cut off. Life is in the blood. And also, of course, life is in the spirit. But here the blood and the life are all one, so far as the physical life is concerned. Now that's now turn with me to Numbers, the 35th chapter, and I want to note here this matter. Begin here with verse 16. I'll not read all of it, but I'll read part of it. 35, beginning with verse 16. Now I'll go on down through it with just a verse here and yonder. But if he smote him with an instrument of iron, so that he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. And if he smote him with a stone in his hand and so on, there the murderer shall surely be put to death. Now I drop down here to verse 19. The avenger of blood shall himself put the murderer to death. Now that avenger of blood was the closest of kin. There. Now then drop on down to the latter part of 21. He that smote him shall surely be put to death. He is a murderer. The avenger of blood shall put the murderer to death when he meeteth him. And it makes a difference between the murderer and the manslayer. I'll pass over that. Now drop down to verse 30. Whoso killeth any person, the murderer shall be slain at the mouth of witnesses. For one witness shall not testify against any person that he died. Take more than one witness. One witness couldn't put him to death. Moreover, you shall take no ransom for the life of a murderer that is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. And you shall take no ransom for him that is fled to the city of refuge. That was for the manslayer. The difference between a manslayer who killed an individual accidentally and an individual who murdered one. Notice further, that he may come again to dwell in the land until the death of the priest. Now look at verse 33. So ye shall not pollute the land wherein you are, for blood it polluteth the land, and no expiation can be made for the land for the blood that is shed therein, but by the blood of him that shed it. That's God's law of capital punishment back there. You have the same law in Romans the 13th chapter there. For let every soul be subject to the high power, no power but of God, power to be ordained of God. He goes on to talk about the ruler, his minister of God, attending continually upon this very thing. That is, upon this matter of executing judgment against the wicked. So the civil government today functions as the avenger did back yonder at that particular time. But blood can be covered only by the blood of him that shed it. Well, now that's what they were not doing in the city of Jerusalem. They were, thou shalt not defile the land which you inhabit in the midst of which I dwell, for I, Jehovah, dwell in the midst of the children of Israel. Now, but you laid it upon the bare rock. In other words, instead of covering it by expiation, by the death of him that made it, it's out there on the bare rock. Well, where is the blood of the murderers of today? On the bare rock. Open before God. What's going to happen? You remember also when Jesus was on trial before Pilate. Pilate washed his hand and said, see to it, I'm free from the blood of this innocent man. The answering cried out, saying, his blood be upon us and upon our children. Right? Now that's where the blood of Christ landed, was on them. Well, what happened? blood can be expiated only by blood. They committed a national crime. Therefore, some 33 years or 37 years later, when Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans, there the blood was expiated by the advent by the Roman government that God used as the avenger of blood of his son Jesus Christ. It doesn't mean that just simply means that what, when they shed that blood and said, blood be upon us, then they paid the national price for a national crime, which was to bring the nation to an end. And the nation that existed then was brought to an end. It's never existed since and never will brought to an end. What exists over in Palestine now is not that which was destroyed back there. By any stretch of the imagination, it's a new kingdom made up of Jews, all right, but not the one who was back there. That nation was destroyed because of the crime of crucifying the Christ. I didn't make him innocent. Don't misunderstand. It simply meant that blood was avenged. That's all. So here he says, put it upon the bare rock. There is a passage also in Isaiah, the 26th chapter, verse 21. I'd like to read that also, if I may. Isaiah 26, verse 21. Start with verse 20. Come, my people, enter thy into thy chambers and shut thy doors about thee. Hide thyself for a little moment under the indignation of the overpassed. For behold, Jehovah cometh forth out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth also shall disclose her blood and shall no more cover her slain. All right, now that's a judgment against the earth, against the earth dwellers, against the worldly kingdoms there, because they have allowed murder to go on and haven't covered it. They tried to cover it up, all right, by letting it go, but it isn't. It's as it were on the bare rock. So this matter, class of capital punishment, is not simply to be determined by the whims of a people or to be determined by a sentimental approach to the thing or an emotional approach. It's to be dealt with solely from the viewpoint of God's order and law, and that God rules in the kingdom of men, and if God says a certain crime should be punished by death, it ought to be punished by death. And if it isn't, someday that nation is going to wash out that crime by its own blood. And that's what we've got coming to us. You can't get a murderer, I don't care what he's done, you've got that ACLU outfit raising all kind of dust in the air every time they talk about putting one of them to death. That outfit ought to be outlawed from any country it ever existed in. Not a thing in the world but an atheistic, anti-American, anti-God, anti-everything else that's good association. I ain't got a bit of use for it in the world. And someday, when the bombs are busting around us here and the judgment's falling upon us and we're washing out the blood with blood, I hope the first fellow that they get will be that outfit. Of course, it won't. They'll be hiding behind some kind of a law protecting. They ought to be the first ones to go. And so the judges and the lawyers, all these lawyers that defend the murderers and get them off the hook, they ought to go right along with them. But if they miss it, they'll get it in hell anyhow. God has his way of ultimately balancing the scales. I've got a bit of use for these lawyers that defend criminals that they know are criminals. And I don't think you have even the judges that turn them loose, got any use for them either. Because why? Why do I feel it? Because it's anti-God. Because it's opposed to everything that God stands for and that God has ordained. And that's going to bring destruction on the nation. Because God says that blood can be avenged only by the blood of him that shed it. So if the American people is a party to it, that is to turn them loose, they're a party to what they've done. Well, that's beside the point, but I had to throw that little sermon in anyhow, of course. There's some things I think ought to be said once in a while, over and over. Even if you believe it, doesn't hurt to know somebody else does too. Because it's not a matter of sentiment with me. Every time we bring on the news about a man being put to death, it leaves me under shadow, depressed. It depresses me. But I know it's right. I know it's what ought to be done. And the penitentiary and jails are filled to overflowing with individuals that either ought to be put to death or put out here to work and make them work hard for the crime there and not sit in an air-conditioned cell watching television and eating good food. We've got the thing all backwards. We've got the thing in the wrong gear. We're going to hurry on. All right? But now notice what he says here then. To cover with dust that it may cause wrath to come upon, came up to take vengeance. I have set her blood upon the bare rock. It should not be covered. They can't cover it up. We can't cover it up. God sees on the bare rock out here all this blood that's shed. Therefore, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, woe to the bloody city. I also will make the pile great. And God said, I'll put the wood under it. I'll be the one that'll do it. I'll put the wood under the cauldron here. Now, and just remember now that this is God's doing and God's own wrath here in this matter. Heap on the wood. Make the fire hot. Boil well the flesh. Make thick the broth. And let the bones be burned. That is, after you cook the bones in there, burn them. In other words, here, then the whole thing, the whole city is going to be destroyed. But now notice further. Then set it empty upon the coals thereof, that it may be hot, and the brass thereof may burn, and that the filthiness of it may be molten in it, that the rust of it may be consumed. All right, now then, after the city is destroyed, now here the siege against Jerusalem is beginning. Now, a year and a half later, it's completed. All right, I mean, they have the breach there, they go into the city and slaughter them there, and send the few back over to captivity in Babylon. Then he's going to burn the city. Now put the cauldron on the fire, make the fire hot, and melt it. Now, the only way you're going to get rid of the filth in Jerusalem is to melt the thing down by fire. Now, so there are several that sins are forgiven by blood. Blood of a sacrifice cleanses from sin. But there's some things that are cleansed or washed by water and are cleansed by the Old Testament. Then there's also fire that cleanses. Now here's a city that's become unfit to continue because of the filth that's in it here. You call it the rust there, the scum, the filth that's in it. Now what am I going to do about it? I'm going to burn it down. I'm going to melt it down and get rid of the rust in it, the filth that's in it, by burning. So here God's going to cleanse it by fire. And so he moves on now to verse 12. She hath wearied herself with toil, yet her great rust goeth not forth out of her. Her rust goeth not forth the fire. Or I think that to me is a contradiction. And her rust is in the fire. The footnote says in the altering. I think it does. Her rust is in the fire. It's in the fire, and will therefore be destroyed by the fire. Now commentators say that these verses right along here are very difficult to translate there. Of course, there's words that are missing or words that may not know what they mean or something, I don't know. But you find there are many difficult translations of these verses 6, 9, and 10, and long, and 12, some of these. But anyway, we get the point. The point is that when I destroyed the city, it's destroyed in the cauldron, then turn the cauldron over on the fire and melt it down. So, I mean, the whole thing, and we've been saying this over and over. He said this several times before, all right, in thy filthiness is lewdness. I had that back in chapter 23, the lewdness of the two women there. In thy filthiness is lewdness, because I have cleansed thee, and thou wast not cleansed. Thou shalt not be cleansed from thy filthiness anymore, till I have caused my wrath toward thee to rest. Now, in other words, I tried to clean you, I've done all I could, and I cleansed and you wouldn't be clean, I provided the means for it. Well, now then, one last cleansing, and that'll be by fire. Well, I guess that's the way this old world will go. God cleansed it by flood one time. He's trying to cleanse it now by the blood of his son. When that failed, what's how he going to cleanse it next time? Well, burn it up. So God acted. The Bible is consistent all the way through this, but on these matters. I, Jehovah, have spoken it. I notice this. The emphatic way he said, I, Jehovah, have spoken it. It shall come. Second, it shall come to pass. Third, and I will do it. I will not go back. Neither will I spare. Neither will I repent. According to thy ways and according to thy doings shall they judge thee, saith the Lord Jehovah. Now just look at it. I have spoken it. It shall come to pass. I will do it. I will not go back. Neither will I spare. Neither will I repent. According to thy ways and according to thy doings shall they judge thee, saith the Lord Jehovah. So look at those emphatic statements there. Positive, definite. Now determined. The siege had already begun on this day, and I'm determined not to carry out. I've listened, I've changed my mind in other times, forgiven them, but this time I'm not. This is final. I think, class, that's the way the final judgment is going to come. I think after God had done all that he could, he sent his prophets, and he sent his Christ, and he sent his apostles. He gave a responsibility to the church, his people, to preach and teach. Now when the world rejects all that God has done, what is there left? Fire. I'll cleanse it with fire next time. That'll be the end of it. But all right. Now that's another one of old Ezekiel's unusual ways of saying things, isn't it? Positive, definite, hard, and yet he's a tender man. Now in this next paragraph, here is our, I guess, about the first and only insight we have into the life of the man himself. Here is one of the hardest things, I think, that God ever called upon a man to do. That is, tonight your wife is going to die. I'm going to take her from you. But I don't want you to weep. I don't want a tear to be shed. Let's look at it. Also, the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, evidently the same day, after he had finished preaching this sermon here, this proverb here, after that, now then, the word came unto him that day, same day, saying, Son of man, behold, I take away from thee the desire of thine eyes with a stroke. Yet thou shalt neither mourn nor weep, neither shall thy tears run down. All right, now this is, as I say, the first insight we have into his private life here, and I'm sure it's the saddest note, one of the saddest notes in all of Ezekiel's book of doom as well as hope, is in this particular part, in this rest of this chapter. Now look at it. Now notice it says here, they run down, sigh, but not aloud, make no mourning for the dead, bind thy head tight upon thee, and put thy shoes upon thy feet, and cover not thy lips, and eat not the bread of men, that is the bread of mourning, the bread that men ate when times of mourning. So I spake unto the people in the morning, and even my wife died, and I did in the morning as I was commanded. I did that morning preach what he told me to. My wife died that evening. The next morning I went right on. I put on my headgear, the head tie, my turban. I also put on my shoes. I went about my business. Would you find that pretty hard to do? I know it would be. That would be hard to do. As the man, she was an idol of his heart like she was. Just stop and think about what that meant to Ezekiel here, to have his wife taken in a time when it looked like everybody was against him. The only person he had who was really for him and in whom he could confide and talk and find sympathy, she's taken away. Taken away. Well, let's go ahead. And the people said unto me, Wilt thou not tell us what these things are to us? If I do it so. Now, they had a premonition that this has some significance. This has some meaning for us. And so what you are doing here is not just because it's the normal thing to do, but there's something to be said for what you're doing. Now, notice what it is. Then I said unto them, The word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, Speak unto the house of Israel, thus saith the Lord. Now, this seems to be the next day, you see, from what we had there in the first part of it. Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, Behold, I will profane my sanctuary, the pride of your power, the desire of your eyes, and that which your soul pitieth, and your sons and your daughters, whom you have left behind, shall fall by the sword. Now, what am I going to do? I'm going to destroy the temple, which is your pride and your joy. And there your sons and your daughters you left when you were brought into captivity, they're going to be slain with the sword. Now, if what's happened to Ezekiel, the loss of his wife, is just almost an incidental thing in comparison to what I'm going to do to your city and to your sons and your daughters you left there, those people that are left. And when I do it, I don't want you to weep. The fact that he does not weep means that you're not to weep either. Now listen, it goes on. Fall by the sword. And you shall do as I have done, says Ezekiel. You shall not cover your lips, nor eat the bread of men, that is the bread of mourning. And your tires shall be upon your heads, as your head ties, and your shoes upon your feet. You shall not mourn nor weep, but you shall pine away in your iniquities, and moan one toward another, but not publicly. Thus shall Ezekiel be unto you a sign, according to all that he hath done, shall you do when this cometh, then shall you know that I am the Lord Jehovah. 54 times that expression found beside 18 with additional thoughts. Now I know why. Why were they not to mourn? Now, if they went about mourning over Jerusalem, that was in rebellion against Nebuchadnezzar, how would that affect their condition in Babylon? It'd be against it. So now that when this comes, don't you make a great ado over that as though you were sorrowing and regretting over the destruction of Jerusalem, because that'll be an indication of your rebellion against Nebuchadnezzar, and your sympathy with the rebellious people over there that rebelled against him, or Zedekiah rebelled against him. So now what Ezekiel has done is to be a pattern for them when Jerusalem falls, when it comes. Now notice the last paragraph here. Alright? And thou son of man, shall it not be in the day when I take from them their strength, of the joy of their heart, the desire of their eyes, and that whereupon they set their heart, their sons and their daughters, that in that day he that escapeth shall come unto thee to cause thee to hear it with thine ears. All right, now I'm going to send somebody to come and tell you when that happened. Now you've already told them it's going to happen. You told them the day that it began. All right, now it's already begun. Now when the city falls, one will come and tell you about it. You can tell them. And here's an interesting thing. Remember back in 326, before I read verse 27. Look back here at, I think it was 326. Well, back here when God told him here. I know we discussed that. 326, and I will. Here it says here, but thou shalt, son of man, behold, they shall lay bands upon thee, and I will make thy tongue cleave to thy roof with thy mouth, if thou shalt be dumb, and shalt not be to them a reprover, for they are a rebellious house. But when I speak thee with thee, I will open thy mouth, and thou shalt say unto them, thus saith the Lord Jehovah. Now that, back there, I told you when we went over that. It seemed to me that didn't mean that he couldn't say anything, but that could say only what God gave him to say. He was not to express himself in these matters, but preach what God could have been preaching all the time, don't you see? But now then, your tongue is going to be, I'm not going to bind you with that anymore. When you learn that Jerusalem is fallen, then when that happens, notice verse 27, in that day shall thy mouth be opened to him that is escaped, and thou shalt speak and be no more dumb. So shalt thou be a sign unto them, and they shall know that I am Jehovah. So now then, that dumbness from 326 seems to me to have been, I don't know this, it just seems to me, that was, he was not to speak except as God. In other words, he couldn't mingle with the people socially, and talk about social affairs and these things, enjoy that as we do today. But all he was allowed to speak was whatever God gave him to speak. Now then, when Jerusalem is fallen, that was a sign to the people now. Right now when Jerusalem falls and you hear about it, now you're freed from that. Now, well, that comes up a time or two later in the discussion here, all that. So at any rate, when that happens, I mean, when you hear that, well, you're now set free from that. Now, any question you have over this, that brings to an end this particular section. These are several, four or five chapters here. We started out back there on the conditions now, and the words of judgment here unto them. Think of that last one. Well, I've got to take that 2021 somewhere back there. That chapter 20, 24, five chapters. That restatement of Ezekiel's basic message here, the third cycle of warning. That brings that third cycle of warning to a conclusion here. Now, I'll not get into the next. I'll probably go two chapters at a time now for a while, because our next section deals with judgment against the nations. Now, up until now, he had been dealing only with Jerusalem and Judah and the people of God. Now then, he's going to deal now with the nations. Now that's an important point, class, in all of the prophets who dealt with it. Isaiah did it, Jeremiah did it, Ezekiel did it, and other of the prophets did it. After that they had prophesied concerning Israel or Jerusalem, whatever they were prophesying, God's people. Then there was a judgment against the nations. And what's the significance of that? That in these prophecies, God is promising the establishment of his kingdom. Now, but all these kingdoms are going to be brought to naught. And the fact that God's kingdom stood was evidence or proof that it was a divine kingdom. So throughout all of this, it was always a remnant. God still had his people over whom he ruled. Now when they came back a remnant, but God was to be that king at that time, and they was to bring in the Messiah, the servant, who would establish the spiritual kingdom that would last forever, that would never be destroyed. Right? All of this points to the fact that these political or temporal kingdoms are all destined to fall, unless it's one or some of them when Christ comes back. But they're all going to fall. But here's a kingdom in the midst of all of these kingdoms that will never be destroyed. That's where that Daniel lived. I think I'm going to go on to Daniel when I get through Ezekiel. Well, I did remember teaching a few years ago, but we'll go back over it again. We forget it. It's always fresh to me every time I study and teach it. So now then, this will conclude for the present. It is three cycles of warnings and judgment against Israel, and not against Judah, and the nation and the city. Now I'm going to pronounce judgment against the kingdoms of the world. Then he's going to come back to the ultimate establishment of God's spiritual kingdom here in the form of a temple in the last few chapters there. So I'm trusting and hoping that we're getting something out of this that will help us here in understanding. If I don't really know what's said, maybe we can learn how God operates. That God rules in all realms and kingdoms. His people are his people as long as they do his will. When they don't, then they become not my people, as Hosea said, not my people, and they're going to suffer the same judgment that the world suffers. Right? But that's what they're looking onto, the coming of a permanent kingdom that would never be destroyed. Do you have any question you want to ask over what I've said? Anybody have a question you want to ask? Anybody want to add anything to what's been said? Most teachers in have the class participation. I never could bring a class into participating in it. As I told you before, I guess because in college, 33 years in college, I never gave the students a chance to get into it. They get me off on everything else, and I never would get my lesson. They would come in, I wouldn't have a lesson. And they get me off on something else, you know. Well, and I just never would allow that. But a class like it wouldn't do that. And if you ever want to say something, or got to ask a question, add your thought to it, I want you to do that. But I'm no good at drawing it out of you.
I'll say something
to you. You do what?
You don't even ask
any questions, you're afraid to answer. Oh, I did try to get around it. My students used to tell me, well, you know, I won't ask that question. You got to it anyway. Hey, yeah, you tell you banned if you don't want that. All right, now, we'll go with that. We'll go a couple of chapters probably next time. Class 68.